Welcome to The Lives They're Living. It's a podcast about people who have done amazing things and who at this point in their life are flying a little bit more under the radar than they really deserve to be. I'm your host, Ben Yagoda. Each week we bring on a guest who can provide expert testimony on the person at hand. The subject for the premiere episode is Jules Feiffer, the 95-year-old cartoonist, and so many other things. My guest is Michael Tisserand. Michael is a writer whose books include Crazy, the subtitle of which is George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. It's the Eisner Award-winning biography of the creator of the classic comic strip Crazy Cat. Michael lives in Minnesota now, but for decades he was a resident of New Orleans and was once the editor of Gambit Weekly there. Most of his books are steeped in Louisiana, including The Kingdom of Zydeco and Sugarcane Academy, how a New Orleans teacher and his storm-struck students created a school to remember. In 2021, Michael published My Father When Young, a collection of 1950s-era photography by his father, Jerry Tisserand. The book's especially resonant because some of the greatest images in it are of Mardi Gras. And for me, one memorable February not too many years ago, I was lucky enough to participate in Mardi Gras with Michael and his family. This computer. So Michael Tisserand, welcome to The Lives They're Living. Very excited to talk about Jules Feiffer with you. Let's start with something I mentioned in your bio, that your book Crazy won the Eisner Award. Now, I think that was named after Will Eisner, who had an important role in Feiffer's life.
Will Eisner was a comics pioneer, one of the first comic book creators. Later on, he sort of popularized the term graphic novel with his great work, A Contract with God. But when Jules Feiffer was growing up, Will Eisner was his hero. Feiffer tells a story that he went to Eisner right after Feiffer graduated from high school and found out where Eisner's office was. He gathered up his drawings and he said, I had no courage, so I don't know how I got myself to do this, but went to his hero's office, found out where it was, knocked on Eisner's door. Eisner welcomed him in, Feiffer tells the story, was very gracious, very kind, and then told Feiffer, I think in Feiffer's words, that your drawings are shitty. Feiffer said he learned a technique at that point that he would always keep with him, which was deflection. And he started talking about Eisner to Eisner and made Eisner really cognizant of the fact that Feiffer knew everything. Unlike all his other employees, Feiffer knew everything about Eisner. He was the greatest fan. He was the greatest groupie. And yeah, he said Eisner had no choice but to hire him.
What were his duties? I mean, if his drawings were shitty, what?
He got better. He got better. Yeah, okay. I mean, he was drafting stories. He ended up creating one of his cartoons, Clifford, which was a little boy cartoon coming out right around the time that Dennis the Menace and Peanuts came out. Mm. I guess maybe that post-war baby boom also took place on the comics pages. And so he was drawing and drafting and contributing stories and doing it all. And that Clifford cartoon might have turned into something, but then Feiffer had his turn in the army.
And then what happened when he got out? I guess going back to Eisner was not quite the thing to do.
So he started going around and trying to become a New York cartoonist, hitting the road, hitting the pavement in New York, knocking on doors and not getting any action for himself until he went to The Voice and decided that he'd work for free just to get a comic in the Village Voice.
Not sure I have all the dates exactly right, but roughly 1955, 56 was started by a bunch of people in Greenwich Village, New York, including famously Norman Mailer, although I don't think he was that involved. He was more like the famous guy. And so Feiffer just knocked on their door shortly after the opening of The Voice?
Shortly after, yeah, it was 1956. By the way, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I asked Feiffer about Norman Mailer one time, and he summed up their relationship like this, that Pfeiffer and Mailer ran into each other on a subway or something like that. And they looked at each other and Mailer said, "Once again, Jules, we have nothing to say to each other."
I guess he didn't mince words.
Neither did at that time. But right, it was 1956 when Pfeiffer went to the Village Voice. And that was in the Voice's first year. And they loved what Pfeiffer was presenting. And Pfeiffer agreed to work for no pay for a period of time in order to get the exposure that the Voice was offering. And that launched 666. That was the first name of what became just known as Pfeiffer. But that launched the comic strip that Pfeiffer stayed with throughout most of his life.
And that's sick, S-I-C-K, 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 not like sick'em.
Correct.
The premise of this podcast is people not as well-known as they deserve to be. And it's not that Pfeiffer isn't well-known. I mean, I think there's probably an adjective or should be Pfeiffer-esque, and anyone who kind of grew up with the Village Voice as I did or knows anything about comics as you know so much about, what he did is sort of unmistakable and Pfeiffer-esque. But at the time, there was no Pfeiffer-esque. Was it like anything? I mean, first of all, what he did at the very beginning, was it like what he later went on to do? And was there anything else out there like that?
It really was. I mean, Pfeiffer entered the Village Voice in many ways fully formed. The characters he was introducing right away, first of all, he used the language of therapy, which was very much in vogue in New York in the 1950s.
Right.
Those rhythms of psychotherapy entered into Pfeiffer's strips. The conversations have an overheard quality when he'd have a couple people talking. I think the first comic was a man and a woman sitting in a cafe, and the one says to the other, "I have a confession to make," and then it's a very shameful moment, clearly, and then this person whispers to the other, "I've never been to Europe." So it's upper middle class at lowest, or upper class New Yorkers and their foibles and pretensions. He introduced two male characters long before the term toxic masculinity came into vogue, but he looked inside of those characters and sort of explored why they were so hyper masculine in very, very funny ways. And Pfeiffer said, I should make clear that this is not just me kind of analyzing Pfeiffer, but Pfeiffer said his work began in therapy. Like, those are the conversations that kind of led to his work.
Right, right. But the imagination to think that could work as a comic strip is pretty amazing.
Right. And he was identified in the national press, including, I believe, Time magazine, as sort of bringing what Woody Allen was doing on the stage at that time into the newspaper print, which is bringing those kind of neuroses consciousness of neuroses and laughing at neuroses to the comics page that we saw in Woody Allen's early humor and later humor.
Well, I mean, not to contradict you or champion Pfeiffer ahead of you, but I think Pfeiffer predated Woody Allen. I mean, this is like mid to late 50s. And I got a quote here that I have to admit I got from you. It was Robert Shelton reviewed Woody Allen in, I guess, the New York Times in 1962, when he was then starting out as a stand-up, quote, "a flesh and blood walk-on from the Jules Pfeiffer casebook."
Exactly.
And wow.
That was in the early 1960s.
Not to get too technical, but the format of his 666, later called Pfeiffer, that I believe he did for 40 1 year, 44 years, some amazing amount of time every week, basically, in the Village Voice. That seems to me not only the content, but the form innovative.
One innovative thing that Pfeiffer did is he broke down the lines, the gutters between the panels.
Right.
So you actually had a fluidity from image to image that did not cross over a little borderline there. He also had a very distinct sort of scratchy line, almost like a sketchbook kind of line, which I think gave a real improvisatory feel to his work. And the speech balloons themselves are kind of broken down to the bare minimum, a line, leading up to some dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, technically, as a illustrator, he wasn't the greatest, but he used that to his advantage. I mean, it seems to me a perfect case of, I mean, I don't know if he would think of them as, or he would as limitations, but even looking at his caricatures of Nixon and Reagan and people like that, they get a bit of the essence of the person, but doesn't really look that much like the person. But I think a word that comes to mind is audacity. That he would have, just the audacity to just go with that. I mean, what do you think about him as technically as a as an artist?
Well, I think the greatness of Pfeiffer as an artist is that he would find the form to match exactly what he wanted to do at any given moment.
Right.
So, he tried to do a kid's cartoon. He tried to do a Peanuts style cartoon, and it was very good and very funny, but it didn't last too long. And but then much later in his career, he had done that great collaboration with Norton Juster on The Phantom Toll Booth, and but never took on writing a children's book himself. But when he did Bark George, those and others as well. I Lost My Bear, I think, is another great one. Bark George is my personal favorite. But he was able to adapt. You look at his, like you said, his Nixon cartoons or his wordy, neurotic New York on the street 1950s, 1960s cartoons, and he was able to adapt that to wonderful children's books
Yeah.
as well. So, and then, the place that we most recognize Pfeiffer's influence, I think, is in Doonesbury, which Gary Trudeau has certainly acknowledged Pfeiffer as an influence over the years. That's no secret. But same kind of scratchy lines, same kind of improvisatory feel, as well as same kind of topical relevance. So you have the kind of drawing in a sketchbook married to topical events. So you visually sort of underscore the fact that he is responding immediately to events as they're unfolding, whether they are events on the street, or whether they're events in Washington, D.C., whether it's a couple people he's overhearing in a coffee shop, or whether it's Nixon and Kissinger or
Yeah.
Trump.
We should talk a bit about Pfeiffer's political commentary. It became one of the things that he was really best known for. And in fact, in 1986, he won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. But the thing that really put him on the map, I think, was his drawings and treatments of Richard Nixon. And here's a clip from a 1974 interview Pfeiffer did with Studs Terkel, where he talked about the way he approached doing Nixon.
The dialogue is written first, and then I cast an actor whose name is Nixon, and then he has to act it out, and then I direct him in acting it out. And in the direction, some kind of psychological understanding and some literary understanding of what transpires goes on, and so you're dealing with the anger in the character and the self-pity in the character and the seductiveness in the character, trying to win over his audience. I've gone that extra mile, he says, with his crocodile smile, trying to get across, but as a sympathetic person, but it not working because he's full of rage and full of self-pity, and it just falls apart.
That's Jules Pfeiffer talking about Richard Nixon in 1974. Now, Michael, we've mentioned that that Pfeiffer won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorial cartoons, but he is also an Oscar winner. Or at least the film he wrote the screenplay for won an Oscar for Best Animated Short. And that film is called Monroe. The premise is, I guess, what you might call absurdist, of a four-year-old who is drafted into the army. Is that the idea?
By mistake, exactly. And it's absurdist and kind of at Pfeiffer's cry against the military and its lockstep approach to solving the largest and the smallest of problems, including the fact that a kid got drafted by mistake. And Pfeiffer said this very much resulted from his experience in the military, where it was not the best of places for him, although his skill in drawing did get him out of other kinds of assignments. So he started working for the Signal Corps, and he actually started writing Monroe when he was sitting at the desk, at his military desk.
Wow.
But and I actually screened Monroe. Pfeiffer was part of a festival called the Improv Conference in New Orleans. We were going to bring Pfeiffer to New Orleans, and then he was ill. So we ended up going to Pfeiffer and doing a recorded interview with him instead. But in advance of that, we screened Monroe, which, by the way, had its debut in Radio City Music Hall as the cartoon in front of Breakfast at Tiffany.
Wow.
But we screened it. Wow. Yeah, we screened it 50 years later or so. And the audience laughed quite a bit.
It still really
does not feel old one bit. And the humor and the rhythms of the jokes aren't aged out at all.
I mean, let me just say that in addition to everything else we're lauding Pfeiffer about, to create humor that doesn't age or doesn't feel dated decades or, you know, more later is a rare achievement. I mean, some of our mutual admirees, people like Buster Keaton and Chaplin, done that. But, you know, a lot of comedy has a sell-by date basically next week. And to have something happen like that of getting laughs, you know, 60 years later is amazing. Well, moving along chronologically and also continuing with all the different forms he has excelled at, my first awareness of him, so 1965, I was 11 years old. You know, I lived in the suburbs of New York. I think my parents would sometimes bring him the Village Voice, and I read the comics and everything, whether it's the New Yorker or the Village Voice. I'm sure I'd seen his work, but my big thing was comic books, you know, Superman, Batman, etc. And then I heard that there was this, I don't know if I knew the term, coffee table book about the comics that I made my way over to the New Rochelle Public Library to pick up. And lo and behold, it was by Jules Pfeiffer. So he was one of the, if not the first people to take comic books seriously. Is that, and I took it out of my local Swarthmore, Pennsylvania library the other day. And I mean, like 2/3 of the book is reproductions of early comics, which is fascinating in itself. But the 1/3 of it is his, it's not exactly scholarship, but it's this really wonderful and exquisitely written essay about comic books.
Yeah, absolutely. It champions comic books not too long after, Dr. Frederick Wortham, released his anti-comics screed, Seduction of the Innocents. So this was Jules Pfeiffer's pro-comics screed. And Pfeiffer, I think a child simply to save his sanity must go underground, have a place to hide where he cannot be got at by grown-ups. And that's one thing that comics allow. Even those comics that Wortham was going after, you know, or especially those comics, the ones with, the indie comics, the horror, the bloody crime novels, the demented horror comics, you know, because that a child can recognize, and hopefully we are not too old to recognize, that that is where the imagination is working in those kind of heated zones. And so it was a place that a child could go. And yeah, Art Spiegelman later said that he could recite passages of that book from memory. I'm not going to say he invented comic scholarship, but he was one of the inventors of comic scholarship with that book.
And I mean, such a good writer. As you know, sometimes have the experience, like when I read Alec Guinness's autobiography and Bob Dylan's Chronicles Part One, that these people, you know, are an actor and a songwriter, and they were better prose writers than me. And that's my, you know, kind of career and thing. I felt that a little bit reading Pfeiffer. Although, as we've said, his not just a cartoonist, he's written lots of different things, but just a brilliant writer. And again, hasn't aged a day in the almost 60 years since it's been published. I want to make sure to mention some of Pfeiffer's other accomplishments. He wrote a darkly prescient play in the 60s called Little Murders that was made into a film with Elliot Gould. He wrote a novel with a wonderful title, Harry the Rat with Women. In the 70s, wrote one of the first so-called graphic novels, Tantrum, and more recently, a memoir called Backing Into Forward. But also, maybe one of the most notable things other than his cartoons are his screenplays. He tapped into his comics enthusiasm by writing the screenplay for Robert Altman's film Popeye, but probably the one he'll be best known for, the screenplay, is Carnal Knowledge. 1971, directed by Mike Nichols, screenplay by Pfeiffer, amazing cast, Jack Nicholson and Art Garfunkel, Anne Margaret, Candice Bergen. You know, I saw it in 1971 at the age of 17, and the phrase toxic masculinity hadn't been invented yet, but this was it. Tell me a little bit about that film and how you feel it holds up and how it gets its themes across.
Well, of course, the great love story in the film is between Jack Nicholson's character and Art Garfunkel's character.
Right.
And they express this through the way they treat and mistreat women. Mm. And that's, you know, that is sort of vintage Pfeiffer, is creating dialogue and creating characters who betray themselves for their audiences and for their readers in ways that they don't see themselves. I think Pfeiffer creates the sort of relationship suspense where the audience can see what the characters do not, you know, and see that they really are. You know, that ticking bomb is what's in their minds, put in their minds by American society, by Western society, by what Pete Seeger used to call the frightened 50s, you know, mentality. Mm-hmm. And Pfeiffer sort of subverting conformity by placing these characters front and center and having them betray themselves with their, you know, that last scene with Jack Nicholson, it's the chance for love, which I do think we see in Pfeiffer's work, becomes reduced to mere transaction.
Yeah. No, I remember that scene. I mean, I haven't seen that movie in 53 years, but it was chilling. Mm-hmm. I remember that so well. If there was like a free association test with the phrase toxic masculinity, some might have an image of Playboy magazine, that kind of icon of the 50s and 60s. And I don't know if it's still around or not, but I guess surprisingly, Pfeiffer contributed to Playboy.
Pfeiffer contributed to Playboy, and Hugh Hefner, among everything else that he goes down for in history, was that he cultivated, nurtured cartoonists. He was a big cartoonist fan and brought in some of the great talents into the pages. Pfeiffer was sort of, as opposed to maybe Shel Silverstein, Pfeiffer was kind of known to not be a great participant in the Playboy lifestyle and the, you know, and the parties and that kind of thing. And in fact, the cartoons he created, the like like the Bernard and Huey cartoons, which led to carnal knowledge, which, you know, put toxic masculinity long, like you said, long before the phrase became coined, you know, front and center for people to laugh at and cringe at. But he did this in the pages of Playboy. And I got to ask Pfeiffer about that, that to put it nicely, the average reader at that period of time and any period of time, even though they joke about they're doing it for the interviews and stories, goes to Playboy to have their male ego be stroked and not have it wither. And Pfeiffer's cartoons subverted that, like he subverted everything else that he was assigned to do. And I asked Pfeiffer, and he just simply said, "Why should I not bite the hand that feeds me?" And that seemed to be that's something that Pfeiffer gave us that we can learn from. When given a task that doesn't quite suit you, whether it is Pfeiffer in the army sitting at his army desk creating Monroe, or whether he's contributing cartoons mocking male ego to Playboy, you know, why can't we put ourselves into our tasks, even in ways that we're sort of expressly being told not to?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you know Pfeiffer, you've talked to them on a number of occasions. And today we've talked about the amazing range and longevity and brilliance of what he's done. And, you know, what do you ascribe that to? I mean, is it just the genius theory of history that, you know, this guy like arose out of the Bronx? Or what was it? What are the qualities that has let him do these achievements?
Yeah, you know, going back to that the Great Superheroes book and his wonderful essay about comics, you know, he made it really clear that when he found comics, he found a way out of middle class conformity, out of his own pains that he was feeling, and I think that's continued to be the way that he draws his own escape hatch. Time and time again, and invites us to go through that escape hatch with him. So I think it's sort of a survival mechanism that he is able to do just way better than the rest of us are. And that's one reason why I love those children's books that he did, Bark George especially. It's just he lets us as very, very, very young children, or in my case, as a father reading to my young child, you know, find those escape hatches together, where you don't necessarily have to squirrel away from everybody. You can actually plunge through those together into a place that's more imaginative, more exciting, and much more honest than we left behind.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I find it interesting that one of his heroes that he refers to is Fred Astaire. I mean, I see this sort of rhythm. You got to have rhythm to be a good cartoonist, but the Top Hat and Tails is kind of counter to the scruffy village denizen idea. But what is it that Pfeiffer sees in Astaire?
It's the dance, you know, and I think it's the most physical of arts, the most improvisatory in a sense, because you are a person, whether in top hat or tails, or whether you're wearing the sort of, you know, flowing garments of the unnamed dancer that does a dance to Spring or a dance to whatever. And that's Pfeiffer's one of his most recurring motifs is a dance to. I think those are Pfeiffer's leaps into beauty, where so much of what he draws, you know, think about his Nixon cartoons, you know, with Nixon as King Kong destroying the cities, or his Trump cartoons especially. Yeah. You know, when he talks about Nixon and Trump, he talked about presidents that somehow found a way to become presidents of our minds. and not just our countries. My favorite Trump cartoon he has, because it is, it's the one that I remind myself of again and again, is of a couple that are just reduced to saying Trump to each other over and over and over again. And at some point they make love and they're screaming the name Trump to each other over and over again. And every time I'm sitting in a conversation with friends and the topic goes to something we all agree about something horrible and ridiculous that the ex-president is now doing and the possible would-be president is now doing, I remind myself of that cartoon and remind how obsessive that is. So, as you know, sometimes Pfeiffer shows our nightmares to us, and then with the Dance to Spring, he shows us the possibility of beauty and shows our greatest hopes.
Well, thank you very much, Michael Tisserand, for talking about Jules Pfeiffer. It has been a pleasure.
I'm going to leave this conversation and go back to reading Pfeiffer again. Okay. It never gets old, and maybe he never gets old. He's going strong so far, let's hear it for Pfeiffer in his 90s.
And now for your moment of Pfeiffer.
I'm not in charge of the line, and it has nothing to do with the thought process. I'm not thinking when I do it. It's where the hand takes me, and I'm following it.